This meeting is now being recorded.
Okay, so let me try again. Hi, this is Gary Kaplan from the Frelle Brown Martell firm, and everyone else is about to be introduced in a moment. I just want to let the folks on the phone and the folks here know that we're recording this session for a future posterity. So I just want to keep folks advised of that. If you're not comfortable with that, you obviously, please, you're welcome to, you know, to not participate, but I just need to give you that warning ahead of time. I was going to just briefly talk about what we're planning to do here, and then hopefully have everybody go around the room and just say who they are and where they're from. So our goal here is to have a truly roundtable presentation. We really want to have an exchange of ideas. We're hoping not to sit here and lecture and then give you just our thoughts up here. We're hoping to really set the table on about a half dozen issues or so, explain to you, you know, where we think current issues lie, and hopefully get input from people about their, you know, experience and views and thoughts on some of this stuff, because I'm going to see firm answers on a lot of these things. And we've already gotten some questions that have come in or some topic suggestions that have come in, but if while we're talking, if other things come up, feel free to raise them either, you know, by just speaking out, or if you feel more comfortable just passing a note to one of us and we can ask the question. I do want to point out that those that did submit in questions, we originally had said in the invite that the best topic suggestion was going to get a bottle of wine. Well, we caved in, and we're going to give bottles of wine to each of the people that suggested topics, whether it's the best idea or not. So at the end of the presentation, will the following people come up and grab their bottle of wine? And I apologize if I'm mispronouncing your name. Saul Armian?
I will.
Okay. Martin Bios? Lauren Borrow? Clay Dunning? Charles Gill, Ted Leiser, Brian McConnell, and Scott Moyer. Okay. So what I'd like to do is just have everyone just briefly, we'll go around the room and just say who you are and, you know, where you're from, what you're currently doing now, if you're not at a particular place in terms of employment. I'll start off here. I'm Gary Kaplan. I'm special counsel here at Frelle Brown Martell.
I'm Jeff Sykes. I'm a partner here. I'm a construction lawyer.
Scott Douglas. Basically, like Jeff, I'm a construction attorney here at Frelle Brown Martell, getting involved in troubled projects.
I'm John Benjamin. I'm a partner in the environmental group at Frelle, and I'm a dirty dirt lawyer.
I'm David Radlow. I'm a Chapter 11 trustee and a receiver based in San Francisco.
My name is Clay Dunning. I'm a receiver in Walnut Creek and Los Angeles.
I'm Peter Phillips. I'm a construction economist from the University of Utah.
Phil Smith, I'm a senior principal at Frelle Arroyo in the Brownfield Remediation. Some experience in receivers and properties.
I'm John Gregory. I'm the environmental partner here at Frelle.
I'm Saul Armian from Armian Group. I'm a court-appointed receiver and a licensed
and
I run AG Real Estate,
which is a property
manager.
I'm
John Daniels. I'm making consulting, and I'm a geologist.
I'm Ted
Coconack. I've been with
Marcus
and Law
Chapter
31 years.
Bill Cosby serves as general counsel for Reed Capital
Management. I'm Seth Freeman. I run Ian Capital Management, where I'm SEC-regulated asset manager, focusing on emerging markets, but also domestic and receiverships, ABCs, restructurings, and so
on. I'm Scott Ware. I'm with Wells Fargo Insurance Services and the real estate practice leader. My colleague, Brian McDonald, is the managing director of construction practice, is not here today.
I'm Charles Gill. I have an independent practice as a construction manager, project manager, including due diligence work and a big variety of projects over the years.
Dana Merker, Merker Architects, Audrey Merker. We do a lot of hotels, retail development, and most of our clients are receiverships, so since we have nothing to do with them, come see.
Court-appointed receiver and expert witness.
I'm Michael Casolis.
court-appointed receiver, referee, and a Chapter 7 and 11 trustee in the Northern District.
Huh? I'm Tamsin McCracken. I'm in private practice as a hospitality and real estate lawyer, formerly in-house Hampton and Stanford Hotels.
I'm Jim Watson. I'm a sole practitioner. I have my practice here in San Francisco. I'm a business litigator. I also counsel employers about labor and employment law issues.
Thank you, everyone.
Great group.
So I was going to briefly just try to talk about some of the topics we're hoping to cover today, and then maybe we'll dive into them. And these are, as I said, primarily the result of suggestions that folks have given us along the way. So the first topic we're going to try and talk about relates to receivership sales and title insurance issues that come up in those sales. Then we're going to go to some environmental issues in connection with property under receivership and the sale of that property. Then we're going to discuss some hopefully surety bond issues that come up in the receivership context, and then talk about some lien issues that come up, both mechanics lien issues and some special liens that may come up, including so-called purchaser and vendor liens under various statutes. Then we're hoping to get to some issues under SB 800 and performance standards and warranties that are required by statute and the extent to which they apply in the receivership context. And probably try to wrap up with some issues. Well, I shouldn't say wrap up. There's two more things. One is dealing with property management agreements that may be existing on property that then goes into receivership and how the existing property management agreements get treated in a receivership. And then hopefully we'll get to talking about some post-receivership dealings that a receiver may have with the foreclosing lender. So let me just briefly try to set the table about the sale and title insurance issues, and really hope we can have folks jump in and give their thoughts on this. So the background is this, as I'm sure a lot of you are aware, there's a California Civil Procedure Code section 568.5 that allows a receiver to sell property with the court's approval. And that section has come up, and the section actually says it's got to be pursuant to some other statutes, essentially beginning with section 701.510 of the CCP, which deals with so-called ex officio sales, you know, when a sheriff or marshal sells property to satisfy a debt. So that's the backdrop of this, and in a lot of cases, a court will approve the receiver selling property and often will do it, allow it to be done free and clear of liens on the property, with the concept being that the liens attach to the proceeds of the property and the buyer gets clean title. So that, for a long time, that's what a lot of receivers throughout California were able to do through the courts. There's been some pushback now. Some courts are refusing to approve sales at all. Some title insurance companies apparently are refusing to give title insurance at all. A lot of this emanated out of a case down in San Jose at for the Sunnyvale Town Center, in which the court refused to approve a sale over the objection of one of the lien holders. And what emanated out of that is title insurance companies suddenly got a lot more reluctant to issue title insurance to buyers in a receivership sale context. And the old reality used to be, if as long as you asked ahead of time, a receiver asked the title company, what do you need to have in the order approving the sale to make you comfortable such that you can give title insurance to the purchaser, title companies had standard language they would give and say, we want to have this language in there, and if you put that in there, we can give title insurance. What's come up in recent cases, and Warren and I were involved in a case where the title companies basically said, we don't care what's in the order. We will not give you title insurance unless there's the consent to the sale from the borrower. Now, this sort of defeats the purpose of having a receivership, because the whole purpose of having a receivership is often because you kick the borrower out of possession and you're not getting the borrower's consent and cooperation, and you want to do the sale anyway. So I'd be interested in hearing from folks about whether, number one, they've come up against this issue, and number two, how they've resolved it, if they've been able to resolve it. Not sure if anyone's had, you know, experience or even thoughts about things they, your creative ways they think might solve this issue.
Well, I'll share. I had a project in San Mateo, a luxury condominium project with a senior luxury condo project that not only provided housing but provided a 5-star dining and an array of other services, and the monthly fees were important to keep that project going. The receivers were allowed for the sale. I went through the process, I was talking with somebody earlier, got the white report from the DRE, retained the title company's subdivision expert to assist in that process, There was no pushback by the title company, no pushback by anybody. Now, we never closed the sales during the receivership. By the time we were ready to close sales, the trustee sale took place. So we actually didn't close the sale until the bank was in possession. So don't know whether that would have been an issue or not. I was very interested in reading the article in the recent receiver's news on this whole topic.
Was the borrower there consenting to sales?
Well, the borrower ultimately stipulated to the receivership. The borrower threw up his hands at one point, didn't have enough money to pay the utility bill, and was looking for help. And they believed the help was the receiver and the money that the bank ultimately put into this project. And you've got a lot of folks retired, living there, and you've got to keep the lights on and provide meals and provide the other services you promised, which ultimately all came together.
So that was a existing facility that wasn't during the course of construction where things
went
awry.
It was fully completed.
Gotcha.
And partially occupied, 40% occupied or so, 30% occupied, and ready to ready to sell.
So we're doing a number of receiverships in Washington, all residential for sale, and I'm not having any issue with how it's going there. And I think the reason is that there's a statute in Washington that authorizes sale of property, specifically free and clear of all liens with any liens attaching to the proceeds. And title companies are relying on that statute to ensure. And I don't know if there's a receiver, if there's a receivership lobby, but I think we need to get that receivership lobby to get them on that on the books. And I think that's what title companies need. They need to be able to point to something.
I can speak to a sale currently going on in receivership in San Leandro, right next to the San Leandro Hospital, 30,000 square foot medical office. I've done a few sales before, and I've actually, due to the Sunnyvale case that you mentioned, got some resistance with title companies, this one with Chicago Title in particular. And we did have to speak to legal department over there and also conference call in this case with the alternate that was legal counsel. And they've been getting tougher. I think what we're seeing and what I'm seeing is the receiver actually in this case, who happens to be in Phoenix. I'm not the receiver, but they're working with me to be the property manager and work with them, so we can speak about that later. But in this case, I think what they're looking to do is to make sure that they have maximum exposure and that they make sure that they go through all of the steps necessary to expose the property properly through a commercial broker that can display to the courts that they have, in fact, exposed this to the maximum number of potential buyers and investors. Because I can tell you right now, the actual borrower has gone and gotten a group of investors who have preeminated an offer through another group and has hired an agent in Oakland and has come in with an offer. And at this point, it's kind of coming through the commercial broker that's been hired. That, of course, again, needs to be a separate entity that has no relation to the receiver. And he has received this offer and, of course, has to forward it to the receiver. That's his job. But, in fact, the receiver now comes back and says, no, we cannot entertain that because we have not exposed the property to another people at this point, so we can put that aside. So I think that may be the hurdle that the courts may be looking to. And again, I'm not a lawyer. I'm just a receiver, but book to counsel to know all of the statutes that you've been mentioning may be coming through, especially due to the Sunnyvale case, which is a big one.
So it sounds like the issue there is trying to generate enough interest in the property such that it reflects its actual market value in the sale.
You know, the issue always comes down to conflict of interest. And again, since I haven't told you exact details, I can give you some numbers. Because the memorandum has currently come through the brokerage and come in at 4.4750 asking price. And that offer that came in was at 4.2. So how do we know that there's not an offer at 5 and more able to come in? We won't know until there's been a few months of exposure going through the marketing plan, you know, the whole marketing program that any commercial broker needs to do. So The conflict of interest, as would be in the Sunnyvale case, is, well, is the receiver also getting a commission? And I don't know. I think in this case there was some issue with that. It was the receiver who had brought in the buyer, and was there a conflict of interest? Is it being sold under market? And that's really what has brought this to the attention of most people, is that are there conflicts of interest going on in here? And are these sales going less than they should be? And, in fact, there was a very interesting article in the Wall Street Journal about this a few days ago that talked about the bondholders of all of these secured assets getting upset because they want the returns, and they're seeing that some of these sales are going for less than they should be.
Interesting.
I would add one more thing on the San Mateo case. While I was going through the DRE white paper process, I considered one alternative, a retail approach to selling one-off transactions of condo units, auctioning all the remaining units, and a bulk sale to an investor. There was about $59 million of value at the developer list in the remaining units. The bank acquired an appraisal. The appraised value in the aggregate was about half that, a little less than half that. We ultimately opted to both bring on a Coldwell banker to do a traditional sale out of the sales office on site, and Cushman & Wakefield to expose it to the market. I think exposing it to the market and making sure you've got a fair price is a very important consideration. We ended up doing both. So we had one-off sales through Coldwell Banker of individual units, and ultimately sold the remaining units as a bulk sale through Cushman & Wakefield. The developer did partner up with a money source and attempted to buy. Their offer was nowhere near the offer we were able to generate through that process.
Interesting.
I had a simple solution I had when I had this problem. I just went to another title company.
I mean, the case we had, there was, I think, a half dozen title companies that were consulted, and they all said the same thing. And I think it's regional, because I've spoken to other receivers in the city.
I ran into that. I found one. I went from First American to Fidelity.
Maybe that's the solution.
I've had the same experience. You just find another title company.
I mean, supposedly, this was the universe of title companies in that area. I mean, it was a small.
Well, mine was good because I've been working with First American for 15 years for Callaways.
Yep.
And their legal counsel, I had gotten involved in the case a year earlier. By the time we sold the property a year later, he retired. New counsel came in and said, no, we're not doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. It can change in that fashion, but I just went over to another company. I shot four.
Lauren, you went and did, you canvassed all the title companies, right?
And we appealed to regional. Yeah, we went over everybody who wants that. And we
And I guess, to follow up on the point, someone had raised the issue of, there being a statute in other states that authorized this. I think the tension here is that the California statute I mentioned, which is Civil Procedure Code Section 568.5, it authorizes the court to approve or allow a receiver to sell property, but it doesn't deal with the lien issue. I mean, those of you that have been involved in the bankruptcy world know there's a bankruptcy code section, which is Section 363, which allows the bankruptcy court to approve the sale of property, and it says free and clear of liens and interest, with those liens and interest to attach to the proceeds. And so that process is pretty clear. For the California statute, it doesn't say what happens to the liens. So the difficulty, from the title company's perspective, is, we understand the receiver can sell the property, but we don't see it in there that the receiver can sell the property free and clear of liens. So we read this literally to say the liens are going to stay on the property. We can't issue title insurance to the new purchaser saying you've got clean title, because the statute doesn't seem to authorize this. And while there is some California case law out there that purports to allow a receiver to do these sort of sales free and clear, some have argued that the cases are limited to their specific facts, and they don't apply unilaterally or universally. And, in fact, there's no statutory basis to sell free and clear liens, and the title companies just don't want to take the risk. So that's the pushback we've heard.
What about going ahead and bonding around those liens and then getting the proceeds for the sale and then using those to pay off the liens? Has anyone tried that before?
Have not.
The case that we were involved in addition to having liens, they just couldn't get over the title company couldn't get over the borrower objection.
Yeah, lack of consent.
And that was really more of the issue in that case.
Because because I could see if there are liens in place. I mean, albeit our statute isn't perfect here, apparently, but you know, you can go ahead and get lien release bonds, 125-150% of the lien amount.
Right.
And then you go ahead and use the proceeds to pay that bond premium, plus you pay off the liens as a result of those liens.
Yeah. Isn't the problem there, though, the diminished net?
You've got
a lender who wants to foreclose or sell through the receiver. There may be other reasons to sell through the receiver, but if you're gonna pay off all the liens,
what's the point? So, obviously, interesting topic that we can't fully resolve today, so I do want to move on to the next one, but I do want to mention one other thing, because someone had mentioned the idea of lobbying. I will tell you, I'm looking around the room, some of the folks here are members of the California Receivership Forum or the various chapters of it, so that might be a source of having people sort of organize and try to, you know, speak through one voice and have the Receivers Forum communicate with, you know, their legislative representatives and perhaps be able to come up with a fix here, and it might be as easy as amending, I shouldn't say easy, but it might be straightforward as amending the Civil Procedure Code section we talked about, 568.5, but perhaps that is a way to go here, especially if folks are encountering this issue more and more, and it's discouraging, you know, the work we all do, that may be one avenue. So I do want to move on, though. I think we're going to try and talk about some environmental issues that come up in the receivership context, and hopefully John will start us off there.
Okay, thanks. See, do I need this, or is that okay without the microphone? Okay, they're taping it, so how's this now? All right. So I'm just going to flag a couple of issues just to sort of stir some debate up have some discussion. Everybody talks about the receiver's sale as being free and clear, referring to it in the title context as well. As an environmental lawyer, I would caution that, you know, what does a scrub really mean? What is the buyer really getting? Because you can scrub certain kinds of liabilities away, like a liability for prior disposal at a site that winds up being a Superfund or state equivalent site. I think you can do that. But if you've got contamination on the property or you've got ongoing permitting problems with an existing business on the property, the moment you become the new owner of that property, that's part of your bundle of rights and obligations. And I don't think you're going to – I know that's the case in bankruptcy, and I've talked to people about receivership, and I don't think it's going to be any different there. So it does mean that if the receiver is going to say, I'm going to give you an as-is, where-is, and you're going to get no reps and warranties, the buyer, if they're intelligent, is going to come back and say, well, then I need some environmental due diligence because I need to know what I'm getting into here. And in the old days, when a property was above water, you could pencil in the remedial increment and still make money. Now that's not the case, so you get into some problems there. So just throw that out for people to respond to. A second issue for the receivers has to do with your own due diligence. There's a case, I'll just read you a quote, because receivers have, you know, the quasi-judicial immunity. That's what you rely on, and you can ask for indemnities from the lender. You might get them, you might not, depending on the deal. But here's a case from Washington State Bankruptcy Court. If a receiver did not analyze the risks inherent in the various known options and bring the risk to the attention of the court and the parties for their consideration in the decision-making process, the court order appointing the receiver will not provide immunity, and a receiver will have to defend itself on the merits on whether it acted with reasonable business judgment. So going from quasi-judicial immunity to business judgment is a pretty scary thing, I would think, for the receivers in our crowd. But what it says is, you know, if you come in as an investigative receiver and you hire, you know, somebody on the environmental lawyer side and a consultant to take a really hard look at the property before you go for your court appointment or as part of that, and then you come in and say, you know, this is what is wrong. This is the expected cost of fixing it. Now, the cost could go up and you can range it and you can cover yourself in those ways, but I think if the receiver, at least according to this opinion, which has been followed in some other places, you know, if the receiver doesn't do that due diligence and properly alert the court to what the risks and the potential costs are, they may be walking their own plank inadvertently. So a couple things to think about. I had some questions also about landlord-tenant issues in bankruptcy, I think from you down at the end.
My colleague, unfortunately, couldn't give it.
Right, well,
think I'll just tee up again and we can have a discussion about it. I think it's going to be pretty similar either way. The landlord's got a problem because he can get in line and the landlord has claims under the contract, you know, the lease agreement, but they're going to get paid in tiny bankruptcy dollars. The agencies have much better claims under the police powers in the Mid-Atlantic case to compel action. But one of the things the landlord's going to have to think about is, you know, I may be secondarily liable, meaning the tenant is liable in the first instance. I'm only liable in the second instance. Well, guess what? You're in the second instance now. And so the landlord has to think carefully with the help of some good team of whether they want to get in there and secure the property, whether they want to make sure there's no releases that are affecting public health and safety, whether they want to approach the agency and try to get the agency to go after the tenant or the owners of the tenant. So there's a whole lot of issues around that, and I welcome any comments on those three things. I just want to flag them for everybody to think about.
On the environmental issue, if it calls for it, wouldn't a phase one report be a basic step that would be done for due diligence? And then if the phase one comes back showing that the testing,
your phase one is an absolute minimum, and it's bringing phase one down. The lender may have done a phase one on a portfolio, and it may be.
I'm sure they would. I mean, if we're talking about commercial loans, the lender would have an idea that if they, you know, commercial loans every 5 years or so, they probably have a good idea. I mean, even in the heydays, they were still requesting and making sure borrowers in their phase ones, and so they should have a good idea
ahead
of time. What is going on with that property?
Right.
In between, if something has happened, let's say there's a driving business or auto usage where you have painters going in, you know, you'd probably get the phase one to indicate, and then you'd have to probably go through the expense of doing some additional drilling, testing to make sure it hasn't hit the water.
Exactly. I mean, your phase one is good for 6 months, so you can't rely on something older than that. You may have to bring that down. And then, you know, I describe environmental due diligence as peeling layers of the onion. You know, you start at the outside, and you may have to go further in, depending on what you find. So if the phase one's clean and everybody says nothing to worry about, you're fine. If phase one says we think there may be some issues around these things, then you might, you almost probably are going to say, the buyer's going to say to the receiver, either you do a phase two or I want the option to do a phase two before I'll buy this thing. Yeah.
John, that Washington case that you describe is intriguing because typically as a receiver you come in and you take the situation as is. Are there specific facts in that case that put the receiver into this predicament?
I don't have it with me, but I'd be happy to talk to you about it offline, send you the case. It may have just been one of these egregious things where there was something that was, you know, maybe should have been known if anybody did a reasonable amount of inquiry and it wasn't done. But again, I would think that the receiver, you know, you can say, this is what I know so far in requesting my appointment. I'm going to conduct an investigation assisted by an environmental consultant, environmental counsel, and then we'll come back and we'll see if we need to make an appointment to stretch the appointment to a remediation appointment or something like that. And so that, I think you could do it in increments, but you just want to caveat, this is what we know so far, and this is what we're doing, so that we're not telling the court that there's nothing to worry about here without, you know, at least making some sufficient due diligence on the topic. Yes?
In anticipation of being appointed the receiver, you want to do some due diligence. Who would actually order who would be the customer for the phase one? And who pays for that?
Well, it can come out of the proceeds. I mean, the lender could provide the phase one at their cost of just updating it, and before they could do that before the receiver even comes on, but make sure that it's up to date. It's a clean, you know, up to date phase one. If not, like I said, if it's an as is sale and I'm the buyer, I'm definitely going to conduct a phase one before I would. If I was representing the buyer, I wouldn't let them go near something without at least going the phase one step. It's not reasonable in this environment to do that, because if the company went under, you know, have no idea what secrets there may be there.
I'm really not before the receiver accepts the appointment.
Right. Well, the lender, as I said before, the lender may have done a portfolio phase one, and those are pretty skin deep, right? So you might want the lender to
to do or have the receiver do with the authority that they have to do a phase one specifically for this property, not for a portfolio of 30 properties where you're really saying, what do we have and do we need to look a little bit deeper? Yeah.
There's a big concern with projects that are not stabilized if it's habitation, condos or apartments, that you're stuck mid-project, and again, we've seen cases where there's environmental insurance on the project. So we have the big hold concern, and any new buyer coming to the project is now going to inherit the down the road, 5-10 years down the road,
Right. Mold is a thing where you may, again, say to the receiver, we want you to take care of that, and the lender doesn't want to touch it. They don't want the responsibility, so maybe the receiver goes to the court and says, I want the thing to do that and take it out of the sale proceeds. And just one other point. If I'm a buyer in a situation where I'm going to get no warranty, no refs and warranties, and I'm going to buy something that has problems, I have done this successfully in the past of going to the agencies with permitting problems that we've identified in the due diligence or contamination issues and say, I'm going to buy this. We understand that this is the problem, and we need time when we close to fix these things. We're triaging them as follows. We're going to apply for this permit they should have had all along, or we're going to get the receiver to apply for it. And, you know, you have a much better chance with the agencies where you go in and you say, you know, I'm going to take this troubled business and I have a plan of what I'm going to do, but please don't come in and enforce on day two of my ownership because I'm the white hat guy gal here. And we've been very successful with approaches like that because the regulators are saying, I want a problem solved. The owner can't do it. The lender isn't going to do it. So if someone is going to step up and say, I'm going to solve the problem, I'll try to work with them.
And these agencies are pretty receptive to that approach?
In my experience, they have been. I mean, I think what it gets you is a temporary mulligan, but if you hit your mulligan out of bounds, then you're in trouble. So, you know, if you make a representation to an agency that within 6 months I'll apply for the air permit that this ongoing business should have had, and 6 months later you haven't done it and you haven't been in contact with the regulators explaining to them why it's taking longer because you need to conduct additional studies because the agency didn't want to issue the permit without them or there's this or there's that, you know, woe unto you if you make promises and you don't carry them out and you don't explain to them why the world has changed and you need a little bit more time.
Aren't you often relying on goodwill, though? An agency wouldn't necessarily have a procedure that says...
No, it's enforcement discretion and deferral. You're basically saying, I'm taking over a problem, but I'm committing to you that it's going to get fixed, and I'm your best hope of getting it fixed, and I might be able to save 200 jobs if I come in and do it this way.
That commitment could be just a handshake.
It could be. Sometimes it's been in writing, like you can get a variance that says you have until this time to get this taken care of. So there's a lot of different ways to do it. Yeah.
Doesn't Clara have a role in this particular issue in terms of providing some guarantees to take a property through the sale?
And sure.
I think it would address some of the issues you're raising as well. Clara, you can identify specific tasks that you agree to do.
Yeah, I mean, there is a role for that. So the Clara statute is one where you can go to a regulatory agency up front, but you got to sign an agreement for their oversight. Oversight, but through that process, you can, and if you follow it through to its conclusion, which may involve taking some affirmative action in terms of remediation, you can get immunity attached to the property, which would run with the property going forward to the successors. But usually, one of the criticisms people have had with the CLAIRE program is you get all into it. Kind of a wild card in terms of what you're going to get on the end result in terms of signing up for remediation. A lot of remediation, which you didn't envision or want to do at the outset. So it's what it is. It is one of the regulatory vehicles that we have in the state here.
Right.
And one other comment about regulatory cooperation and the like. I know there's been some discussion among the state agencies, at least from the with respect to the cleanup as a portion of this, the Regional Water Board's Department of Toxics, that despite the fact that there are issues about short staff.
worked with the law before, as well. There's big bureaucratic state firm, but they're human beings at the end of there, and you can speak with them and meet with them. So I second.
Question. In terms of the phase one, I'm coming at this as someone that does a lot of phase one. So I don't know the legal side of it, but are there any protections under all appropriate inquiries or receivers in terms of even where you have a distressed property or contaminated property, which is the proper CF standard, you have protections even if the property as is on the seller's end.
No, the issue I was talking about was whether the receiver might lose their qualified judicial immunity for not doing due diligence. I think if a receiver made sure that there was a phase one that was up to date, or if not updated a phase one, and it says there are no issues here, if it later turns out that there's plutonium in the back 40, the question will be, was it reasonable for the receiver and consultant to conclude that based on the phase one that there was no need to look out there? I mean, if there was evidence that they should have seen or decided to overlook or whatever, that's a different fact pattern than you got a clean phase one and everybody just missed an issue where there was no documentation for and no if people interviewed didn't know about it or whatever. So.
But if there was identified, if you qualified purchaser, at least have known problems.
Yeah, well, the Superfund, and then this would take a whole session, so we can talk about it offline if you want, but, Superfund, federal, and some degree the state, provide, innocent purchaser or bona fide purchaser exceptions. I describe them as safe harbors that lack water. They're filled with pitfalls and trapdoors for the unwary, and, you really have to think through very, very carefully what does all appropriate inquiry mean. I mean, we had one case where the client insisted on going to EPA, and because they had a pond, an unlined pond that had been used for aqueous waste discharge, and they said, well, there's no need to go sink borings any deeper than 20 feet below the pond because these kinds of things don't migrate and groundwater is 300 feet down. And I said, if you go ask EPA, they're not going to give you the simple answer, they'll give you the CYA answer, and they did. And EPA said, well, if you really want to do appropriate inquiry, in our view, you need to put borings down 300 feet to groundwater. Drilling 300 feet for a temporary well or a permit well two or three times, that can ruin your whole day. That's an expensive proposition. So, be careful what you ask. You might get it. So I think they could have made it a very good case for all appropriate inquiry without asking EPA. But once they asked them, they were stuck with the answer.
So I was going to add one point to this, and hopefully we'll move on to another topic. On the judicial immunity concept, as I'm sure a lot of you are aware, there's a statute that essentially grants the receiver judicial immunity if acting within the scope of their receivership. So the trick here is to make sure that the receiver, the initial order appointing the receiver or a subsequent order that allows the receiver to do investigation and remediation are broad enough so that the receiver can essentially get immunity for any act done in that context. In other words, so if he's authorized to, let's say, oversee a phase one, and that's what's done, and someone later argues you did this wrong, phase one was all messed up, the receiver can confidently say, well, I was authorized to do this, this is in the scope of my receivership duties, therefore I have immunity. So the key here is to make sure that you get an order from the court that gives you broad enough authority to do what you're doing, and then the immunity should protect you in that situation. We're going to try and move on to some surety bond issues. I think actually Scott and Jeff are about to have published an article in the Receivership News on surety bond issues, and I'm hoping they'll start the topic on that, and hopefully we can have a discussion about some of those issues.
I'll start the conversation by observing a couple of things about the suretyship industry. It is not the insurance industry. It's a different industry. It's an industry that's been under a lot of economic pressure for quite some years. And although this recession has increased the pressure on the industry, I don't think that the pressure is decreasing at this point. In fact, when I speak with general counsel of large construction companies, companies that were constricting seriously during the beginning of the recession, they're now, for the most part, doing well, but their subcontractors are not. I spoke with a general counsel of a national construction company about a month ago, and he said, within the past 18 months, we've had defaults of between 40 and 50 subcontractors. In the 18-month period immediately before that, we had subcontractor defaults maybe two or three times. And for years in the construction industry, general contractors have been waiting for that other shoe to drop. And I think what's happening, at least the common wisdom that I think we all embrace, is that prior to the recession, subcontractors were very successful. They earned a lot of money. When the recession hit, they had a lot of money. And in order to keep their people, they started bidding projects at very thin margins or even no margins, effectively buying projects and bankrolling that risk or that calculated loss with the cash they had accumulated before the recession. And that cash has only lasted so long. So I think within the industry, we're going to see more subcontractor defaults before we're finished seeing the results of the recession. Now, having said that, I'll observe there are really three types of bonds that I think we in the room would be looking at. One would be a performance bond, typically for a contractor, where the surety promises the owner that it will perform the contractor's obligations if the contractor does not. A second would be a payment bond, where the surety promises the subcontractors, material men and suppliers of all tiers, that the surety will pay them if the general contractor does not. And the third is a form of performance bond, and it's typically obtained by a developer that promises the completion of common interests, common areas, clubs, and the like in connection with large planned unit developments. But all three of them have the same commonality. They're three-way agreements. There's a surety, there's a principal that the surety is guaranteeing the performance of, and there's an obligee. There is one or more parties who have the right to enforce that obligation under the bond. What's very different about suretyship and insurance is, like insurance, to obtain a bond, you pay a premium. Unlike insurance, to obtain a bond, you promise indemnity. You basically promise your firstborn and everything else that you have or will in the future acquire to protect that surety in the event the surety needs to perform. And that really is sort of the gravamen of the dynamic. So we've got pressure on the industry. We've got sureties who either are protected because their principal can indemnify them, or they're not protected because their principal cannot indemnify them. And that's really going to drive, I think, how they behave. Michael, before we started, was talking about being involved with a surety for a failed general contractor, and the surety wanted to get in and complete the project ASAP, which is the surety's interest, of course, because it wants to retain the employees of the failed general, it wants to retain the subcontractors, and the like. In my experience, when sureties do perform, it's because they know that they have an exposure. They know they cannot look to the indemnity to protect themselves, and so they're more willing to perform.
Especially in a default context where you have a contractor that's basically going bankrupt.
Right. By going bankrupt or has gone bankrupt. The flip side is surety is just playing hardball. Surety is not performing. Surety is banking on the fact that the obligee, the owner or the developer, will not have the financial wherewithal to pursue the surety, and that the surety will be able to outspend, outdefend, and outlive the obligee. And so that's a completely different dynamic. And then yet another issue, and that is, what are the defenses available to a surety? Putting aside the surety's rights or risks, one of the biggest defenses for a surety is exoneration, that the obligee, the owner or the developer, has done something or failed to do something that exonerates the surety's obligations under the bond. And one of the favorites of sureties is, you did not cooperate in the investigation of the claim. And I've seen sureties suck in owners and developers to that defense by simply not insisting that the owner or developer cooperate and letting a lot of time run during which there is nothing done by the owner or the developer, following which that period of time, the surety raises its hand and says, you know, you've exonerated me. I waited 2.5 years for information from you with regard to this claim. You've given me nothing. You've prejudiced my interests as a result of that, and I have no more liability to you. So having put those various dynamics out on the table that I think are rather unique to sureties, and we're talking broken projects primarily when we talk sureties involvement, I'm interested in your experience with sureties, what you've seen and how you've dealt with the issues that you've been dealt. Yeah.
I'm on the insurance side, not the surety side, but a number of my colleagues have been this light to call it. I guess it's the word I would use over the last 2 or 3 years. And it becomes a bit of a downward death spiral for some of these because, as you said, they were cash flowing projects prior to the recession, and now that cash has run out. And it's a big issue with the stuff. But it's become much more difficult to secure these surety bonds. Litmus test that the obligee has to go through from a financial standpoint is pretty deep diving.
It certainly is, and before the recession, the market was very soft, and so sureties were underwriting with little or no concern, really. And we've been involved in some very large claims on bonds where we've been able to take a deep look at the underwriting that was done before the recession, and we realized everyone was out after premium. They didn't see the risk. They were just trying to capture as much of the market as they could. And when the recession hit, then the risk became obvious and significant.
Are you seeing a lot of personal guarantees, indemnity, the strength of that indemnity is because of what stands behind it, right? Are you seeing a lot of personal guarantees?
Always.
Go ahead.
Yeah, that's always how sureties underwrite their products. They're always, you know, it's a tragedy when there is a default, and people lose their houses oftentimes. It's tragic. But, getting back to the failed projects, I mean, when you're a receiver and you're coming into a project that is midway complete, you're trying to figure out what's going on, you're trying to figure out what the stage of completion is, and you're trying to get the project completed, obviously you're going to be looking to the performance bond, and ideally, as the receiver,
as a part of the appointment order, you're going to get that bond. You're going to become an obligee on that bond as well, that you can go ahead and enforce the performance guarantee. So that if there are liens out there, you can go ahead and get the surety, go ahead and fulfill the obligation to go ahead and bond around those liens under the performance bond. And if there are payment claims out there from subcontractors, this is all in the ideal world where there are payment bonds and performance bonds on that project. Oftentimes there aren't, but if there are, then you're going ahead and looking to the payment bond surety and the performance bond surety to fulfill those obligations so you can get that project off the dime and moving forward and complete it.
Are you seeing a lot of political cooperation where you have these projects that the owner or obviously default? If you want to keep people employed, you want to keep jobs alive on the project, are you seeing cooperation support?
It varies across the board, obviously, but I mean, from a surety, from a receiver standpoint, what you want to do is obviously get there on the ground and evaluate as quickly as possible. And then get things moving forward, because the more disruption, the more cost. You know, once you get people demobilizing, then they got to remobilize and everything else, and that's all cost. And to get them back on the project site, they're going to be looking to get paid those extra costs, and so. You know, from the lender standpoint, you want to go ahead and do your due diligence, go in there with informed consent, but then also get things moving forward quickly.
I'm interested in wondering if you've been involved in situations where you have a project, there's subdivision bonds outstanding, the municipality isn't enforcing the subdivision bonds, but you want the municipality to enforce the subdivision bonds, and whether you can go into court and get that, if that's successful, get a court order to require.
So we were recently involved in a very large subdivision project in Hawaii. I think it was 700 or 800 luxury lots, a golf course, a club. There were subdivision bonds running to the county, and there were performance bonds running to the homeowners association and the club, which owned the golf course and all of the amenities. The county did want to enforce the bonds, and we represented the homeowners association and the club, and we actively assisted the county in doing that. The county was using its in-house lawyers. We augmented them. We did a lot of their legal work for them, handed them completed pleadings and motions and the like, and we were arm in arm going against the surety, and they very much appreciated that. The surety in that case, by the way, just stiff-armed everyone. They stiff-armed everyone. That was a little unique because it was on a small island. Part of the condition of granting the subdivision was that a bypass highway be built that would solve the traffic condition that existed for about 30 years on the island. So everyone on the island was in favor of that bypass. No one cared about 600 wealthy families moving from wherever to their island. In fact, they'd probably not have that happen if they had a choice, but the highway was of public interest. And the way that case resolved was the sureties paid enough to have that highway bypass built, but not enough to have the club completed or the subdivision improvements completed.
So there they had the government entity, that which was the obligee, had the incentive obviously to go ahead and pursue that bond. What you're talking about, though, is where they're just stalling and they don't have the resources or whatever to pursue it. And in that situation, I don't know if you, especially if it's not a priority item for them here, it's a priority item because it's a roadway and everything else. But if it's...
We have a similar situation in non-receivership projects. Whether a judge can take action on it, can force the city's hand.
Are there not writs that you can obtain to force an agency to perform?
Their obligations, yeah. You could do that.
How long is that process, though?
It's not overnight, obviously. I mean, ideally, it'd be better to cajole the municipality to do what they're supposed to do. But if they're not willing to do it, then it's going to be a hurdle.
The unwillingness in today's world of a public entity not pursuing its rights under a bond, I think, is the result of not having the resources to do it.
Yeah.
Not that they don't want the improvements built. They just, maybe they don't, because then they'd have to take them over and they don't want that. But if it is a matter of resource, offer them resource.
Yeah, I mean, another interesting issue there is whether there'd be any third-party beneficiary rights under that bond that could be pursued, and I don't know the answer to that.
One last thing about suretyship. Most bonds are written with very, very archaic language. It's called defeasance language, and it goes something like this. If the principal performs, the surety has no obligation. Otherwise, the surety has an obligation. Well, what does that mean? And by the way, suretyship is one of the oldest professions. It's referred to repeatedly in the Bible. I mean, it really is. And this defeasance language has been around since, you know, English common law. And we're still using it today. Some of the more modern bond forms are different. They really do articulate what the surety's obligation is. But if you have one of these arcane bonds, the surety basically has five options. But they're not spelled out in the bond. But one of them is buy back the bond. Pay the penal sum of the bond. Just buy out the liability for the penal sum. That doesn't happen very often. The second option is where you as an owner have default terminated the contractor and placed demand on the surety. Have the default terminated contractor come back to your project. You know, just when you were breathing a sigh of relief that the red pickup trucks were finally gone, they show up again on your project. Most owners don't want that if they've default terminated. On the other hand, if the contractor is simply unable to perform because of a lack of financial ability, the owner would want a surety to pay and help float that contractor through completion. A third option, hire another contractor to complete. A fourth option, complete yourself as the surety. No surety will do that. They'll hire a contractor because they're not in the business of doing that. The fifth option, which is the one pursued probably most often, is to do nothing. Seriously. It's a legal option available to a surety. Do nothing. And one of the reasons that a surety may want to do nothing is that if it does perform and the principal says, wait a minute, I was not in default. You had no obligation to perform. Your performance was as a volunteer. Then the principal can succeed in avoiding its indemnity liability to the surety. So the surety could be performing and spending the money to perform and having no right of indemnity back from the principal. So that do-nothing option really does happen.
Yeah, it does. It's oftentimes the surety will go ahead and stand behind their principal and say, for the reason the principal says they're not in default, we agree.
So we're going to move on to some lien issues now, and I'm actually going to hopefully talk about a arcane statute you may not be aware of, and then hopefully we'll have some discussion if folks have had experience with it. So I'm sure a lot of you are aware that there's something called a vendor's lien in California by statute, and it's California Civil Code Section 3046. Essentially provides that when someone sells property and they have not been paid the purchase price, they have a lien on the property against the purchaser until they get paid, which is not very surprising or controversial. What folks may not realize is that there's a lien that goes the other way around in favor of a purchaser of real property. And I'm going to read you the statute and then translate it into English. It's Civil Code Section 3050, and it says, one who pays to the owner any part of the price of real property under an agreement for the sale thereof has a special lien upon the property, independent of possession, for such part of the amount paid as he may be entitled to recover back in case of a failure of consideration. So when this may come up, for example, and it actually happened in one of the cases Lauren and I were involved in, if there's a condo project and someone buys a condo unit in the building and pays money to the owner of the project, and the owner goes off and spends the money and is gone, the person that bought the condo doesn't get rights of possession right away. The project may still be being built, etc. The lender steps in and says, well, we're going to foreclose on the property. We haven't been paid by the owner-developer of the property, And you know, our view is our liens are above everybody else's. We recorded a lien. No one else recorded a lien. We're going to take over the property. It's going to be free and clear of any, you know, junior liens or junior interest, including any interest that someone says they have the right to, you know, own a piece of the property in terms of owning one of the condos. So in that situation, the condo purchaser is going to have a disputed issue with the lender here, because it's really dueling liens. Of course, they're going to say, the condo purchaser is going to say, no, I've got a lien on that property. Even if you foreclose, I still own the condo, and or at least a lien equal to the value of what I paid for the condo. And the lender is going to say, sorry, you're out of luck. I didn't see your lien on my title report. So what? There's another statute that sheds light on this dueling priority, and it's Civil Code Section 3048, and it provides that the liens that are set forth in Sections 3046 and 3050, which is the two statutes we just talked about, the so-called vendor lien and the so-called purchaser lien, are valid against everyone claiming under the debtor except a purchaser or encumbrancer in good faith and for value. So what that means, at least what the courts have told us that means, is if the bank had lent money to the borrower, to the owner of the property, and had, didn't know about the condo sales, they're a so-called good faith purchaser, and as long as they actually gave good dollars, lent good dollars, that's value, they again essentially get to trump the lien of the condo purchaser. If, on the other hand, the lender knew about these condo agreements, they were copied on the correspondence, they were sent copies of the condo purchase agreements, courts say they're not a lender in good faith, not that they're in bad faith, but the fact is they can't say, oh, we had no idea about this other lien. They are charged with this knowledge of knowing about the condo purchase, and therefore charged with this knowledge of knowing about the condo purchaser's lien, and they're junior to the condo purchaser's lien, and they can't foreclose or sell the property free of this condo lien. So this has come up in the receivership context when a receiver goes to sell property, let's say a condo project or something like it, and will try to sell free, sell the entire project to a buyer, and the buyer may come in and say, wait a second, I'm not sure you can even give me clean title because there's this lien there that seems to jump ahead of the bank's lien, and unless you pay the condo purchaser off, I don't see that I'm going to be able to get this property. I'm going to have a property, but without the condos inside of it. And there often is a negotiation that results from that in terms of what the party's respective rights are. In order to get the sale done, you as a receiver may need authorization to either yourself or have the bank go essentially pay off these condo purchasers so you can sell the project. Otherwise, no one's going to want to buy a project that's got these holes in it. So I'd be curious to see if anyone's come up against this issue or you know have insight into this issue, because Lauren and I had it in a case recently. And in fact, it's the first time, well, actually, it's the second time that it's come up in my experience. Okay, let's move on.
Rich, what if the lender has lent money to develop the property, understanding that money is the actual payments haven't been made at the time they lent the money, but they clearly know that that's going to happen to the original. Under that circumstance,
well, good question. I don't know that there's a case right on point, but I think that the cases say it's a fact by, case by case determination based on the facts. And the issue is if in giving them to the construction financing, the lender knows what's going to be done with the project. And maybe they haven't seen the condo purchase agreements, but they know that's the objective and there's, a business plan that says that. I think the lender is going to be on the short end of that good faith argument and not be able to say, we had no idea there'd be these condo purchase agreements jumping ahead of us. So then the other liens issues we want to talk about is there's some changes to the mechanics liens laws in California that are going into effect, I think, July 1st. And I'm hoping that Scott or Jeff are going to shed some light on that.
I'll address that and also talk about it within the context of troubled projects and failed projects and whatnot. Starting July 1 of this year, there's going to be an overhaul of our mechanic lien statutes here in California. It's pretty dramatic in terms of the overall impact is all going to be reshuffled to a different part of the civil code. But in terms of the actual impact, it's not going to be significant. Substantively, it's more or less the same. There's some terminology changes and that kind of thing. But again, it's really intended to go ahead and streamline it a little bit more, make it a little less arcane, and to make it more understandable for people. But substantively, there's not going to be much difference. There is a couple things to note, though. Notice of completion, now instead of 10 days, you can go ahead and do it within 15 days. Notice of completion is going to be important for receivers because it truncates the lien period from 90 days for contractors and subcontractors and suppliers to 60 days for generals, 30 days for subs and suppliers. So that's going to be important. And then also with respect to lien release bonds, mechanical lien release bonds, the penal sum of those no longer have to be 150%. It's only 125%, but still, it's still an issue out there. But so substantively, it's more or less the same. Some tweaks to the numbering system, some tweaks to the terminology, but we're basically in the same general area. Different forms, different notice completion form, different notice of preliminary notice forms, different lien release forms for payments. So receivers are going to be needing to be cognizant of those changes because, again, when you're doing the progress payments and final payment, you're going to have to be using those lien release forms, and those are dictated by statute. If you don't follow those substantially as it's written in the statute, then those lien releases are no longer or won't be good in presenting liens. But in any event, when you step into a broken project as a receiver, you're going to probably be confronting a lot of liens at that point. And again, if that project is a project with performance bonds and payment bonds, you can look to those to try to satisfy those liens and get the project back on track. If you don't have those in place, then you're going to have to struggle to figure out how to deal with those liens, to get those liens addressed so that you can get the people back on site and back on the project. If typically the lender will have a deed of trust that's recorded on the property, and that's typically done prior to the groundbreaking. So in that situation, then the lender would have priority over the follow-on contractors that come and do that work. So if there is adequate value in the property such that there is some value there above and beyond the debt, then you're going to have to deal with those liens. If you're going to go ahead, if the project itself and the property itself is underwater, then you're going to go ahead and foreclose, then you're going to wipe out those liens potentially and the foreclosure process. But, if you're going to go forward with the project as the lender and as the receiver, then you're going to have to deal with those liens. And I think that you're going to have to go ahead and probably bond around them in some instances, at least prior to the sale of the units and such. But what do people see out there? How do they deal with lien issues when they come onto a project, a broken project? How prevalent is that? Do people deal with that much here? Clay, no?
If you are involved in a project that has mechanics liens, you might want to consider how you can defeat those liens. Mechanics liens in California are a constitutional right, unlike many other states. And therefore, mechanics liens involve a taking of property that requires that there be some due process afforded to the property owner to address that taking. And in the 70s, California recognized that if a lien is filed, that the owner of the property can attack that lien by filing a lawsuit to enjoin the lien and to have the lien removed. In the early 90s, the courts recognized that if a lien is filed and the lien claimant files to foreclose on the lien, the owner can attack that lien by way of motion in the same lawsuit. The case is called Lambert, and the motion is referred to as a Lambert motion. So you can attack a lien in the same lawsuit. Now, last week, a case came down in California that said a lender cannot do that. Only an owner can do that, because the constitutionally protected right is the ownership interest in the property, not the fact that you've loaned money as a lender with regard to the property.
Now, that's a big case. It's interesting in that it basically says that lenders don't have standing to attack the lien themselves. Only the property owner can, even though the lender has an interest, a security interest in the property and a security interest potentially in the loan proceeds that haven't been issued yet.
Here, I don't think a receiver was involved, but if a receiver did step into the shoes of an owner, then it could attack the lien under Lambert. Now, there are a number of bases upon which a lien can be attacked. One of them is it was filed prematurely. The new lien law makes clear what the cases recently have defined, and that is the lien right arises only upon completion of the work by the lien claimant. The most recent case to address that is one that came out of a project in Oakland, and the facts of that project were a contractor was converting a warehouse to a high-tech server facility for an internet company. So it was doing a lot of electrical work and HVAC work and the like, and the owner ran out of money and told the contractor, stop work. I've run out of money. And the contractor stopped work. And the contractor demobilized, and the contractor had two people on the site at the job office cleaning up the files, and the owner said to one of those two people, hey, there's some HVAC ductwork on the fourth floor. Would you drive your pickup truck up there, load it into the back of your pickup truck, and bring it down here to the first floor? And the fellow, being a good fellow, said, well, sure. And so the issue became in that case, was the work complete, or did moving that ductwork comprise some of the work, because the lien was filed before that ductwork was moved? So it can get as factually picayune as that. So there's a premature lien. The amount of the lien. A lot of contractors think, well, I have a right to a mechanics lien, so I'll calculate the amount as being the difference between what I've been paid and what I think I ought to be paid. You don't have a lien right for what you think you ought to be paid. You only have a lien right because you've added value to the property. And the amount of the lien is defined in the old statute and the new statute as being the reasonable value of the improvement made to the property or the amount agreed to be paid for the improvement, whichever is less. So, if a contractor has a right to recover more than the reasonable value because it's entered into a contract that permits that, it doesn't have a right to lien for the contract amount owed. It only has a right to lien for the reasonable value of the improvement. So you can attack a lien based on the amount of the lien. You can attack a lien from any subcontractor, material man, or supplier if they did not give a 20-day preliminary notice. The purpose of that notice is to give the owner and the lender actual notice that you're out there performing work on the property so that they in turn can assure that you're paid and protect themselves against your lien right. If a subcontractor does not give that 20-day notice within 20 days of starting the work, it can give it at any time during the course of the work, but it has a lien right only for the work performed after that 20-day notice and forward. It has no lien right for the work performed before that 20-day notice. And then the last way to attack a lien is you filed it too late. You filed it too late. If you had a lawsuit already pending on the lien, you go in and you make a motion. Now, that motion is not a simple, quick process because you may need discovery in order to prevail on that motion. The new statute works a significant change in the law. It says you can file a petition to release a lien from a property, and the court must hear the petition within 30 days of filing, and the court must issue an order on the petition within 60 days of filing. So now you do really have an expedient way to attack a lien.
And that best works within the context of a stale lien where the lien has been recorded but the foreclosure action hasn't been filed within 90 days thereafter.
Right.
On the reasonable value question, I assume it includes reasonable overhead profit for the contractor or materials?
It's just materials. It's just
labor and materials and equipment.
Labor, materials, and equipment. The theory being I've improved your property, ergo I have a possessory lien on it by way of my constitutionally protected mechanics lien right, but only to the extent that I've improved your property. So overhead, no. Profit, no. Delay damages, no. Damages for disruption or acceleration or lack of productivity, no. None of that can be the subject of a lien, but it typically is. either because contractors don't know any better or because they try to overreach on their lien rights?
Jeff, it's probably too early to have a cite for that very recent case. I think you said it came down last week. Is it in our materials today?
No, it's not.
Okay. So we're going to move along, but one thing I wanted to mention on these mechanic lien issues, because they can get very complex, as a practical matter, what often happens is, in the receivership context at least, the receiver will approach the mechanic lien claimant and say, we're trying to sell this property, and we have two choices. One is we're going to go through a court-approved receivership sale and knock out your liens. It's going to be free and clear of liens. And you can try and fight it out with the bank in terms of the proceeds, but if you recorded your mechanics lien after the bank recorded their lien, it looks like you're out of luck. Or alternatively, if you're in a court or dealing with a title company that won't give you title insurance, the lender can foreclose and essentially wipe out these liens unless these liens were recorded for some reason ahead of the bank's lien. So given that leverage, what often happens is a deal is cut and some money is thrown to the mechanics lien claimants to make them go away, but often a lot less than what they're claiming on their lien because they are faking the reality of getting nothing and or perhaps having to litigate for a long time and spend a lot of money and, until they can get paid anything.
One point.
Bankruptcy, there's also a bankruptcy court in some cases simultaneously going on.
Yep.
There was a case I worked on that wasn't in receivership or in custody at this time, but I was hired for 766 Harrison. And that got defaulted on from a bank down in Southern California. Then got taken over from the FDIC, but the owner had been filing bankruptcy. And since I was getting paid as a consultant, I had been getting the notices on the bankruptcy process. So I've now been viewing all of the subcontractors that have been demanding their money. Quite significant, a lot. And at this point now, they're having to settle, as you said, down to maybe 10 cents on the dollar.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah.
So, there's, again, I know we have some other things on the agenda, but it's very complex in terms of the number of tracks that go on.
Yeah.
Another important point to kind of follow on with Gary's point is that liens, in terms of priorities, it's not so much a matter of when the lien is recorded vis-a-vis the deed of trust, because irrespective of when that contractor starts work on that project site, if it's the painter who's on the tail end of the project, that lien right arises when groundbreaking occurs by the original contractor. So it's not a matter of looking at when that lien was recorded. You have to go back and factually look at when groundbreaking occurred on the project and then determine whether or not the deed of trust was in place and recorded prior to that.
That's a good point. I mean, and I don't want to belabor this, but I want to point out often the fight comes out even before, they break ground or anyone starts any work, there's a construction lien that jumps, that's there first. But what happens is that's often replaced by actual lien on for the operating property itself once construction is finished. And the question is whether the subsequent lien relates back to the original construction loan or not. If in the interim you've had someone start work and their mechanics lien otherwise would jump ahead. And that's where there was often a fight between the construction and now operating lender versus the mechanics lien claimant. But I do want to move on. We do want to try to talk about, hopefully Scott, you can set the table for us on the SB 800 issues and how they come up in the receivership context.
Sure. SB 800, which is basically the anti-Oz statute. Oz is a California Supreme Court case of a decade or so ago, which basically said that homeowners and homeowners with problems in their units do not have a claim for economic loss unless there's personal injury or property damage. That's the economic loss rule, basically. And so the homeowners in that case were out of luck for the most part because they were code violations that didn't result in loss. Well, the legislature in California came up with SB 800, which is basically an anti-Oz statute that sets forth performance standards for various components of construction, doors, windows, stucco systems, that kind of thing. Basically say water can't go through or intrude or pass underneath or anything like that. So SB 800 creates performance standards that apply to builders and contractors and suppliers and that kind of thing, and also warranty obligations. There's a fit and finish warranty of 1 year, and that applies to builders. And what's interesting about the term builder under the statute, the term builder, and it's a little circuitous or a little, well, let me read it to you. The term builder is defined as any entity or individual who, at the time of sale, was also in the business of selling residential units to the public for the property that is the subject to the homeowner's claim. I don't know what that means. It seems like everybody would be a builder who sells a unit. So in the context of a receivership, ideally, as a receiver selling these units, you want to go ahead and avoid all those things, right? You want to go ahead and sell the units as is without the performance standards in place, without the fit and finish warranty that applies. It's a one-year fit and finish warranty, by the way. And but if you sell it as is, are you also, in that instance, relieving the contractors and suppliers and designers of their liability as it relates to the performance standards? Or do you carve that out from the as-is clause? I don't know. I don't know if anyone has had experience with that before, but the more you go ahead and whittle away warranties and performance standards, obviously you're going to have an impact on the sales price. And so you want to go ahead and try to keep that sales price as high as possible without disclaiming everything. So potentially what you want to do is have a carve-out from the as-is clause that allows for homeowners to at least, or unit owners to at least pursue the contractors and subcontractors and potentially designers for the breach of the performance standards. And then also potentially what you want to do within that sales context is assign rights, the developer's rights, under the general contract and under the subcontracts. They wouldn't be parties to the subcontracts, but they would be third-party beneficiaries of those subcontracts, and they could ideally assign those rights to the purchaser as well. So that's kind of, you know, it's a balancing act because you want to go ahead and disclaim as much as possible, but then you don't want to go ahead and take away from the sales price, so you want to try to give back something as well, ideally involving third parties. Anyone have experience in juggling those issues? No? So the receiver retains those implied habitability, for instance, warranty of habitability?
Yeah, you know, for whatever that's worth, because then the receiver goes away. So I think
Right. Ultimately
that's how we got comfortable, because if we were there for...
Yeah, because the receivership estate is only there for a short duration, and habitability issues typically aren't going to be emerging very quickly.
Yeah, so we concluded that our liability on that was...
Seth? Well, I imagine the receiver would be fulfilling that obligation, assuming that the developer is in default and doesn't have the financial wherewithal to go ahead and because typically until the 50% mark is reached, the developer is paying those unit fees, right, to the HOA, and if they're not able to do that, then it would be, I guess, the bank would be funding that ultimately.
Unless there's a bond. Unless there's a bond securing that obligation.
Can the receiver attack that as some kind of lien, quasi pre-existing claims?
Well, I think the way it works, well, first of all, I think the CC&Rs run with the land, and I don't think there's a way to sell free and clear of those or to get out of those. I think usually the HOA agreements are they're contracts,
mm-hmm.
And typical receivership order will provide that the receiver has the authority in his or her sole discretion to reject or terminate any contract that the developer was a party to or the owner was a party to and is not required to perform the obligation under that contract. Now, there's a breach of contract claim that emanates from that. Usually it's worthless if the property is underwater. It's an unsecured claim that goes behind the secured lender. So the typical dynamic is the receiver says to the HOA, we're about to terminate this contract unless we can restructure it in a way that we think it, you know, works for us. And, you know, play ball or we'll just reject the contract, you'll get nothing. And that's, you know, usually how it works.
Okay.
So I was going to leave you with one other arcane tidbit statute or actual rule of court that may come up in your practice as receivers. So this is California Rule of Court 3-1179B as in boy. And what it says is, and I'm just going to paraphrase, says the receiver may not enter into any contract with the party that obtained the receiver, usually the lender, concerning the role of the receiver with respect to the property following a trustee's sale or termination of a receivership without specific court permission. So the way what this is really saying is the receiver can't huddle with the bank before the receivership sale or before the foreclosure and say, you know, I want you to hire me, or you know, and here's how it would work, and have any sort of arrangement like that. And the reason is the receiver is supposed to be an impartial officer of the court. And that's what the rule says. Now, as a practical matter, you know, in this situation, the lenders often want continuity, and if they're going to foreclose, the folks that they know and trust are the receiver that's been running the property during the entire receivership, and the practicalities of it are, often there are arrangements made between the parties before the sale actually happens as to what's going to happen next. It's not like the sale happens and suddenly everyone's, you know, wondering who's going to manage the property the next day. So the reason I tell you this is just so you're aware of this rule, and I think there are ways to make sure you comply. And one of the things is to say you're allowed to do it with court approval. So in either the receivership order or in the order authorizing the sale, one way to skin this cat is to put in language saying that the receiver is authorized to enter into an agreement on reasonable arm's length terms regarding management of the property post-receivership or post-foreclosure, but it shall not impact the receiver's, you know, duties and the party's respective rights during the receivership. In other words, it's like almost like you're two different people. You are the receiver while the receivership's going on, and then you become this other person once the sale closes, and the two really are supposed to be different roles, and you're wearing two different hats. So I think that's the safer way to go. I mean, just understand that, and I understand that oftentimes folks are not that careful, and this happens without court approval. Just be aware that there's a risk that if you have a party that is not happy with the whole process, often it's the borrower that, you know, didn't get along with the receiver, doesn't like the bank, wants to cause trouble. They may object to the receiver's getting his or her fees at the end of the day on the grounds that they haven't complied with this California rule of court, and the receiver may end up, you know, losing a chunk of their compensation based on the argument that they're not unbiased, that they are really acting in the interest of the lender. So I just want to make you aware of that rule out there because it's arcane. A lot of folks don't know about it, but it can come back to bite you, especially if you've got somebody that's sort of a pest in the receivership case. So we're past our time. So any other questions, comments, concerns?
Great audience.
Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Good job, everybody.
Thank you.
As you can make it.
So those who suggested the topics, don't forget your wine.
Don't forget your wine. Good point.
We're going to take whatever you want. Take it alphabetically.
There you go.
Sign off.
Very good. Thank you.